Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the FASD Success Show, episode number 64. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. Thank you so much for being here. And whether it is your first episode or your 64th episode, I am so glad you are choosing to spend your time here with me. I appreciate it. If you like the show and you're picking up what we're putting down, don't hesitate to subscribe wherever you're listening to this, wherever you get some podcasts. We are probably on almost every platform, and if we're not, you let me know. It's so important. The more subscribers we get, the more we tell the algorithms that, hey, this podcast is excellent, and anybody searching for FASD info in podcast form, we pop up, and then boom, we're helping people, because hopefully we help you. That is the whole point of this podcast. It's FASD success. It's about creating success. It's about finding out about success. It's about finding out what makes people successful, frontline workers, individuals on the spectrum, caregivers. We want to know. And the best way to do that is to talk to people. The best way to do that is to talk to amazing people that I've had the privilege to chat with either before. You know, now the podcast is 64 episodes deep, so there's new people as well. It's just, it's all around, it's excellent. So I really appreciate that. I'm stoked about our guest today. I'm really stoked. We're going on a journey. We're going on the journey. Could you imagine not being 57 years old? Can you imagine not getting a diagnosis of fetal alcohol till you are 57 years old? That's our guest today, Rainier DeSchmidt. It is excellent. It's a deep conversation. He's an individual on the spectrum, but he's so much more. And not having a diagnosis until that late age, I'm not going to say late age, is because my birthday is next week. I'm going to be 40 years old. I don't know if I've ever said this on the program before, but I am May 15th, 1981. I'm going to be 40 years old, and I'm not mad about it. I'm not sad about it. In fact, I don't mind getting older because life seems to get a little bit easier in terms of being able to put a roof over my head and buy some food and feed my family. So that respect, it's good. I like getting older because I like maturing. I wish I could mature and have the mindset of, you know, even Rainier's mindset. I guess he's 61 years old now, but we'll talk to him about that. I like maturing. I like leveling up. I wish you could speed it up a little bit, but you can't. So this is, I'm here. I'm at 40 years old, and I'm looking forward to it. I do look forward to it, or does it just happen to you? Either now or in a few years, my doctor's appointments are going to change a little bit, going to get a little bit more intimate, and that's cool. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it. My birthday is next week. I was thinking about that because when we were talking about age with Rainier, we're talking about, that's why I didn't want to say, you know, 57 is old and 61 is old, because the older we get, we find out that that's not old. But so much experience with this guy, so much experience. And I've had the pleasure to chat with him online. I've had the pleasure to speak with him in terms of going to, I think we were in the Sioux Lookout, where I'm from, Northern Ontario and Canada, to speak at a conference together. And he just has so much insight, not only because of his story and because of his upbringing, but because he is on the spectrum and not finding out till you were, till it was, you know, he had leveled up. He was such a high level in his life. It's just totally interesting. It doesn't matter. I get asked this question, you know, does it matter at what age to get a diagnosis? No. I say always pursue getting a diagnosis. It just gives so much insight. Not only does it let the individual know, it lets others know about what's really going on. And we talk about that in the interview today about how, you know, he works so hard to keep it together, but there's this mental storm that he was dealing with, and literally going on a 5-decade journey to try and find out what was wrong with him, because his parents said, you know, what is wrong with you? I got a warning, though. Here's a warning. It comes with a language warning. There's a few F-bombs in here. I just don't want to censor people, so it's in here, and I believe we'll make sure it's on the blog. Warning, warning. But if you're an adult and you've listened to an adult conversation before, it happens. Also, just know for your kids, like this. So if you're playing this in your car and your kids are around, you might want to do it at a different time or tell them to do earmuffs, whatever the case may be. I don't even have really a bio for Rainier because he's done so much. Like he's a business owner, he's a media artist. You know, he's a speaker, an FASD speaker. He's a life counselor, and you're going to learn all about him and just get into the mind of an individual on the spectrum, and the quotes are flying, and I'll talk to you about it after, but I'm ready to go. Are you ready? All right, let's go. Here I am, friends, with the incomparable Scott Rainier the Smith. Rainier, how are you?
I'm happier now seeing your smiling face in front of me here.
That's right. And it's not even forced. It is good to see you. And I tried to derail you, not on purpose, on playful, because you are an artist. And I remember, I think it was one of your first gigs. Correct me. This is the theme of the whole show. Correct me if I'm wrong. Sure. I don't know. Was it your first paying gig? And the first thing we were working together, the first thing you do when you come on stage, I always remember, you're like, hey, my name is Scott Rainier de Smit. I didn't really like it. I'm an artist. I changed it. No offense to Scott's. I think it sounds cooler.
So I switched to Rainier at 40 years old. Yeah, absolutely. I said, Scott, you got the first 40 years. Rainier, let's see how you do it the next 40.
What was the response from your circle when you were from Scott to Rainier?
It's interesting. My let's say my creative friends thought, oh, awesome. Yeah, much like it was just a duh. It's a 7-letter palindrome. Like, come on. It's like they're going, yeah, you should have done that years ago. My what I call my more straight-laced friends and parents, they're like, well, what's wrong with Scott? My mom, until the day she died, like about 4 months ago, she says, you know, she'll introduce me as Rainier, but I call him Scott. I gave him Scott because I like Scott better than Rainier.
And I brought that up because it struck me, like you said that first, and you are creative, and your journey is of one of creation, man. You are, correct me if I'm wrong, and it only serves narrative purpose for the narrative. You are 60 years old now?
61
years old.
But Jeff, it's important that everybody listening understands that I've got the body of a 58-year-old.
You do. You look actually really good. And take this as a compliment that I hope I look as sharp as you when I level up as much as you have so far. But here's the kicker, man. How old were you when you received your diagnosis of fetal alcohol spectrum disease?
56.
So
five and a half decades of sneaking under the radar, as we say.
Right. And it would have been sneaking if you knew, because sneaky is knowing while still doing it. And you did not. So so what I'm saying is this story is 6 decades long and it's still progressing. You know, the best is yet to come for sure. And so what I like to do is, you know, we will make it a Forrest Gump like adventure and just jump decades ahead. The purpose here. Okay. So let's first start. At any point when you were younger, did you realize that maybe you were neurologically different besides being your own individual, that maybe it was something more?
Right. Got it. So I think if you took the word neurologically different out of it and they just said, did I feel or suspect I'm different, that would be probably accurate. Because, of course, as a young kid, I didn't have any concept that, you know, people could be mentally in different boats, so to speak, or in running different races. And so very early on, I was reminded constantly by my parents that, you know, what the hell's wrong with you kind of thing. So I kind of felt like my normal didn't fit in So my only assumption as a kid then was to go, well, then I must be off base somewhere, which was kind of a weird thing, because it led me to decades of self-exploration and trying, self-understanding and trying to seek what was quote unquote wrong with me.
What were they saying was wrong with you?
Well, it's kind of, now I understand. I mean, it's basically a standard list of FASD behavioral symptoms or examples, but, hyperactive, attention deficit, I was very precocious. I was very, boundaries. The good news was boundaries didn't really stop. Like, I'd try anything. I'd look after anything. I was curious about absolutely everything. And the bad news was I had no boundaries and I was absolutely curious about everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so no, did you have other diagnoses? Like what, or did you just fly through? Is that what kind of happened?
Part of the reality for, again, to help the listeners understand, mm-hmm. this is like the first of the 60s. So like 60, 61, 62 is when I was like a 2-3-year-old toddler. And I mean, my mom and I were really blessed. We've had a lot of conversations since, but the whole thing was that there was no Dr. Spock book on how to raise a kid. There was nothing. It was basically spare the rod and spoil the child, or maybe the other way around.
Whatever. Old school.
Old school. Yeah. This was, I mean, again, we'll probably talk about it up ahead, but the whole thing is, this is a time when a doctor would be sitting with his feet up on his desk, smoking a cigarette, telling the mom, a glass of wine is going to be good for you and the baby. It was a different world as far as education and knowledge went. So.
No, that's 100%. That was even before the first official paper on FASD even came out.
I thought you were going to say the first official paper. I thought, no, we were.
No. By Lemoyne.
Post-Egyptian time.
Yeah. I'm not trying.
You're right. There was no FASD. Yeah. You're absolutely right.
And I'm not trying to. That sounds bad. I'm not trying to date you, dude.
Doesn't bug me.
You're saying it was the standard practice. Now, because mental health and even other diagnoses weren't really around, right? No. That's when they used the MR word, right? Mentally. So, R word.
Yep.
And so, but you, so then coined, were you just a coin like a shit disturber?
Of course, back then people didn't use that exact term, but I was a problem child. So it translated to today's term shit disturber for sure. Yeah. Part of the challenge, and this is a whole conversation in itself, I didn't realize until much later in my life, but my IQ or my smarts was pretty high in the midst of this other mental storm going on. And I had a very good personality, which again is a lot of folks on the spectrum, the FASD spectrum have that, there's something about them. You like about them because they are honest and they're
cool. Yeah, totally. So it's hard on sleeve, genuine. I find it's some of the dismaturity is good because it's like that childish wonder and enthusiasm. Like that's what I get from around you. You can tell the high intelligence right away. You only have to talk to you for 30 seconds. And you could tell it's not just cocktail talk, meaning
it's the Python quotes, dude. It just lets people know I'm an intellectual.
But what I'm saying is you could tell, but it's also a double-edged sword for expectations on you.
Highly.
As you were growing up and maybe relationships with others, was that the common thread? Like, and I don't want to all bring the, but what was this, where did you have hard time maintaining relationships? Was the consequence to the neurological symptoms of impairment that you didn't even know?
To that double-edged sword of, I'm developmentally challenged and I'm also very developmentally advanced in certain ways at the same time. I think, and it still happens to this day, I wrestle with this. Part of it is I set up a certain expectation right off the bat because, and again, I would like the listeners to understand that until about I was 56 years old, I thought I was an idiot most of the time.
Mm.
But, I was actually smart. And the thing was, people would meet me and go, wow, here's a really neat guy. He really seems to be together and that. He's an artist and all that. being an artist also gave me a little leeway for being eccentric. But the thing is, the other core things that what I call my FASD engine, it's still running at full blast. And I'm spending a lot of energy managing that. And what happens is most of my friends who get close, they're intuitive and they sense something's off. They hear that rumbling noise in the background and there starts getting a bit of a distancing. It's almost, and I'm realizing there's a suspicion of inauthenticity towards me, which is very interesting because it's true. I'm not actually being fully authentic. Once or twice in my life, especially with a couple life partners, I said, okay, you want to see me? I just turned off all my filters and it was me for about, oh, I think 10 minutes. And they were like just sweating by the end of it. I think that's what my universe is.
And oh
that's
my gosh. So, and I'm,
they didn't stick with
you. Spend all your energy managing that. That was so powerful.
A large chunk of it.
You're managing these symptoms. The engine is going 1,000 miles an hour. Your thoughts are going 1,000 miles an hour. Just the environment, all the stimulation you're taking in, and you're trying to put on this perceived notion, and it didn't leave room for progress in other areas because you were exhausted.
That's yes. Although when I was younger, I didn't even have exhaustion. That was, to be honest with you, as I get older, I appreciate exhaustion now. After a good hard day at work, I appreciate when I just go, thank God I'll be exhausted when I get to bed and I'll be too tired to think. But when I was a younger man, that was the weird thing, Jeff, is that there wasn't peace from it. I think that's, I don't know how to get that across.
No,
it was eternally exhausting.
Yeah. Was it a lot of conversations like why can't I, or why do I, or why am I?
Yeah. I mean, I got into heavy duty meditation and personal growth stuff in the 80s and 90s to try to answer that simple question, who am I? Because, and I mean, I eventually sorted it out just through grinding at my life, or again, ironically, just before the diagnosis, I think I got a much better sense of me, but there was so much around it. Really, the question was, why can't I be normal, was my universal mantra for, you know, 5 decades. I mean, now on the other side of all this, you know, 15 years later, it's a really, I don't want to be normal.
Yeah, agreed. Now with embrace, you are your authentic self. Yeah, you can be, and people accept your authentic self.
To a degree, I would say that's not been my full experience. What I'm still finding, I still need to manage expectations.
Some folks. Okay. So,
Almost, because what happens is my close friends, they understand I don't hide my diagnosis, and I also don't, I don't wear it on my sleeve. Got I don't it. Use it as an excuse. So very quickly, people, again, slide back into that, well, Rainier's a really smart, normal guy, and when I do something kind of out of the box, it surprises them, even though I've said, well, I'm going to do that from time to time. There's times I'm going to be a problem. I'm going to over interrupt you. I'm going to do this. And it still surprises them. So what I'm finding is other people have their own way of coping with people. Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
And
that's fair. And I just hope I could take you at your authentic self, gathering what happened. And it wasn't, and when it, so we'll just keep you up to date. This was supposed to happen before, Rainer got sidetracked. He was a little bit late and I was like, not a big deal, honestly, because it's on to the next thing because, well, I know you're awesome and intelligent and all of these things that, time management is an issue for some folk. So it wasn't directly to me. It wasn't, oh, he's doing this willful and purposeful. He doesn't respect. Right. He doesn't. I was like, dude forgot, was probably busy. And my direct email to Yvonne was like, hey, can we just reschedule this? No problem. So the fact, so I'm, you know, that's my goal with educating people so they can take individuals on the spectrum at their authentic self.
But an interesting part of this, I think, Jeff, is to so that's your side, and I honestly totally got that. I wasn't, ironically, I know you, and because of your studies and what you work with in your life, I wasn't worried about you, but it was amazing what I said to myself. It's amazing right. The feeling that happened to me. Even in my communicating back to you, I wanted to mention, I really respect your time. That it wasn't so much that I thought you did that. It's almost like to remind myself that I know that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Agreed. And that's even I got from, because I told my wife, I told Tara, I was like, he doesn't need to apologize. I was like, he's apologizing. Yeah. I told him not to apologize. He keeps on apologizing. And she goes, let him apologize because it'll make him feel better. And,
yay, Tara. It was trippy. It was a selfish moment, but it was funny. But I knew you could take my apology.
Dude. Oh, yeah. But so bring it back to the point of that is authentically you once in a while. Right. Mm-hmm. And now, but then I also knew when, you said, okay, I'll make sure next time. And you totally did. And that's totally in character. And now it's almost better because you're not at the end of the long day,
this is much better. Yeah.
Right. And so that's also a lesson in not scheduling things back to back out of the want to please. I do that too. Do you jam it? So, and you say, you know what, let's wait a few days or a week. We'll do it when I'm in a place. You know, like this, where we can sit down and nobody's rushing and nothing's happening. We got a long way to go, I guess, if you still have that, because you would never tell by looking at you or the way you speak or you are a business owner any of this internal battle goes on. Now, I'm going to fast forward. So I guess one of the things that individuals on the spectrum have a tough time with is the executive functioning issues, planning, organizing. How were you younger when it came to being independent, or were you subconsciously interdependent? How was that phase like for you?
Wow. Well, I would say probably let's do teenagehood, high school, that kind of zone. I was totally the thing about pleasing people. I was because I always had this absolute committed knowledge that I wasn't from planet Earth and that at any moment someone is going to find that out. I was extremely sensitive to being part of some tribe or the group, but I didn't do drugs. So I didn't hang out with the druggies. I didn't smoke cigarettes. I didn't hang out with the smokers. I wasn't focused enough to be a chess group person. Mm-hmm. The only thing that saved my ass was the music program, really. But there was always this, again, management of having another person be my friend that I could go, I'm connected to one person that is accepting me in my own universe as best I am showing up,
So, you always tethered yourself. I like that word tethered, right? Mm-hmm. And you tethered yourself to somebody where, you could say, hey, what was that again? Or you sort of lean.
Part of me using that, we used to use in the old days, which is like four or five years ago, the external brain concept, in FASD stuff. And, I still to this day am aware I have that. There's times where I have a couple of friends that I will check in and say, this is what I'm thinking about this. What's you're thinking about my thinking? Mm-hmm. And I don't in any way feel bad about needing to do that. I know neurotypicals will do that too. But for me, for a lot of my life, it was a lifeline because so many times I would make decisions that would burn friendships, burn those bridges, burn jobs, burn whatever, that I lost faith in my ability to navigate, quote unquote, the normal world.
Wow, dude, well said, man. Like that's well said. This is gonna be like a quotable movie, right? It's very true, because you 61, the hindsight you have now is powerful. And I picture so you went through your high school. How did you transition into adulthood? Like you figured out like you were creative. The thought of making a living.
I think so. I did the, my parents had, you may have heard this again, from their generation, you know, being parents in the 50s and 60s, they got quickly, I was creative, and that was a bit of a problem, not a good thing. It's different than nowadays where, you know, good, go to art school, kid.
Yeah.
This was really, it was constantly with my music, with my photography. It was always, that's nice, but you, what are you going to do for your life? What are you going to do for a living? That's nice that you can do that, but what do you, you know, what's your day job going to be? So to answer part of your question, after I got out of high school, so much of this was about getting a job. You know, my dad comes from a generation where your job is your career for your life. There wasn't this, you know, you're going to have three or four careers in your lifetime. That was not that in his universe indicated a failure. Where nowadays, of course, we kind of go, well, if you haven't had four or five careers,
yeah, the average is eight. Yeah, the average is eight.
For eight. Wow. Yeah. So they were back in the time when it might be two if you're lucky. So, you know, my parents were pretty strong on go to college, you know, get out, get a job. I tried, retail seemed to be the best place. Ironically, I could use my personality, I was a good salesperson, so to speak, and all that.
They would call them soft skills.
Exactly. My soft skills were very good in that area, although I hated, it was a lot of stress in working for someone, because again, I mean, I still remember specifically a manager at Eaton's, an old-time department store.
Eaton's catalog, bud.
You got it. You know, I remember one manager taking me back in the back storeroom and giving me the talk, you know, like, sometimes, Rainier, I know we get stressed and we turn to substances to manage. And I'm going, are you giving me the drug talk, dude?
Yeah.
Well, no, there's no shame, man. I said, I'm not on fucking drugs. Fuck, man. And it's like, and I remember just that was one of those life moments where the shoe really dropped. I'm going, holy fuck. So I'm 24 at this time. I'm going, holy fuck, it's not working. It's not working. I am not fitting in. I'm not disguising.
Yeah, things. Like I'm trying. This is not working.
Yeah. And it wasn't so much the accusation of drugs, because that didn't really offend me as much as it was, you're not acting normal and I'm calling you out on it, kind of thing.
Yeah, you aren't, I got in caught. Line socially.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah,
my mask, my Halloween mask. I'm going to all these doors and people, oh, it's Rainier. Fuck, my mask isn't working. They know who I am. Damn.
Oh my gosh, scary. That's such a good.
It's scary.
You got caught. You didn't do anything wrong, but you've been trying to mask it for so long, and then all of a sudden, this guy says, I can see. So you think you're under the radar, you're blending in, yet you know your idiosyncrasies and your symptoms, and they're like, hey, this guy must be on drugs,
right?
Because normal people, air quotes, don't act like that. And wow, great. I'm glad you. Thanks for sharing that, man.
Not a problem. This is one reason, Jeff, I've just lately been, for some reason, remembering one of my favorite bands from the 80s, Devo. And I mentioned this song. They had a very strange hit back in the 80s called Mongoloid. And a lot of people, 10, 20 years later, got in a lot of trouble because, of course, it was a derogatory term compared to when it first came out. And everybody thought this was a real nasty song making fun of someone with mental, R word. And it wasn't, it was actually the main lyric was he wore a hat. He had a job. He brought home the bacon. So no one would see that he was a mongoloid. And it's funny. The whole thing was, I didn't realize until recently when I was going through my old music library how much that song hit me at the time. But I didn't. Now I look at it so differently. I do not have that visible of a mental disability, but I've got a big mental disability. And there is this feeling of I'm constantly trying to make sure the hat's on right. I'm trying to make sure, literally bringing home the bacon. Being a successful self-employed man has been so important that, you know, to push back that thing that, you're not doing the human thing right, dude. You're off. It's exhausting. Like, I had a target of what other people said normal is normal, and that's my target because they said that, so, you know, and this is what you do. I think the other thing that's really important here, though, Jeff, I want to address, which is as much as I'm an absolute advocate for be who you are, I still also in my deep gut and heart know that we all have to modify a bit to relate to each other. We all, like, if I just show up in my flaming, raging, it's true, I'll have the satisfaction of being me, but I wouldn't blame a lot of people for hanging out there. It's intense. It's hot. It's uncomfortable. It doesn't make it wrong. But I think all of us, we find our bridges to connect with people. I think the challenge with me was I couldn't find a bridge. I'm yelling across the chasm all the time and trying to pretend there's a bridge there. Don't worry. But in my universe, there wasn't a bridge. I was just faking it again, you know, pretending hope.
Well said. When you say authentic is intense, you know, we're not talking, you're not like aggressive punching holes in the wall. Like what?
No,
Take me through because I picture, this is how I picture it. Okay. That's the way I work too. Okay. So
I think you and I are brothers that way. I think we have similar energy modes.
So I picture you like at home, in your place, cause you are creative. Mm-hmm. And is it just like tarps off, ripping music, writing things down on the board, pacing, or is it sitting and your mind racing? Like, what is that intensity like?
When I've been my most freest with my creativity and with my expression, let's take it two steps. Let's talk socially in one box, and one box, me as an artist expressing, you know, writing a song, editing photography or editing videos. When I'm at my most free, I'm up and around. I may have two or three computers going at once doing different functions. I may be up and making a hot cup of tea, and the next thing I might be going in the bathroom and taking a shit. Meanwhile, I've got my phone with me and I'm making notes while I'm doing the business. Okay. And, you know, very multitasking. I learned a long time ago that's the best way I work. And I also learned a long time ago that most neurotypicals cannot be in the space with me while I do that.
Ah, fair, man.
That's nothing about them being wrong. I get. So that comes back to my full point about being fully authentic does have an effect.
Sure. So if you were that intense on a shoot, like you've done work with me, you filmed me, like I should have known you were 61 because we got you the cake.
I forgot. Yeah, the birthday
for your
cake.
60th, right? I can imagine that when you were filming me, if you were being your authentic self, like you're right up my face doing shots, running around,
on my back, camera up. Because that's, I see all those things in my mind, but I also know, again, I think a lot of it is discerning. For me, this is important. I discern without judgment my choices and actions because I'm presented with a massive amount every given second. And without resentment is different than going, I think when I was a kid, I was suppressing myself, trying to fit into a very narrow slot, and I resented it. I hated that. That's so. And I didn't even understand. I just knew I was surprised. Now I do it as a choice to do my job better, to interface with the world. It can almost look the same, but it's if you get the sense, when I was younger, I was a victim to it. Something was happening to me that I had to do. I had to suffer. Now it's more, no, I choose this. This is my better way to interface with the people I want to interface with.
I picture me talking to the crowd, and if you were being 100% authentic, I wouldn't have been able to do my job. I would have been watching you. That makes 1,000% sense.
So let's go to a band. To me, this is a music band, to be clear. This is, if everybody gets up there and showcases their talent in the same instant, you just got a lot of noise. But a real band knows how to shift the bass, the drum solo. Sure. And boy, that makes a whole thing that's just brilliant. So a lot of the times I feel like I'm a 5 or 6 piece band going off, and I have to manage it. So the song I'm giving, as corny as that sounds, the song I'm giving out to the world, it is inspiring, is harmonious, is engaging and fun and good to listen to. Not just a bunch of noise coming at people.
Totally. This is the part of the Forrest Gump movie, or a part of any epic lifelong narrative, where you went on this epic journey. I remember talking to you when we were having social time when we were working together, and the the things you did, the retreats you went on, the just do that. Just take the next few minutes and what were some of the things, the teachers you were under, what you were looking for, the study? Because I was like, wow, that's far out.
But
you were going on such a journey.
So this is what I call, this is what I call the light that came from the dark side, you know, of my disability. Because I had that burning sense that I don't belong, and yet I was here, and I was aware that I was here, you know, I'll be blunt. So the option is to get the fuck off the planet, be done, or let's sort this out. And so very early on, I think first marriage, I would have been earlier, mid-20s, to be fair, mid-20s, tons of anxiety. You know, I had ulcers, the whole thing. Trying to work retail is just hell. And I remember a buddy of mine, ironically a gay man, which back then was kind of like, having a gay friend was, you know, and he says, you know, I go through a lot of anxiety too. And he recommended that I go to this meditation clinic. And it was very simple. You know, you sit on a table in a dark room with a bunch of other people, and some lady, I remember distinctly, sounded like Mary Poppins. Imagine yourself in a bright colored blue ball of light. And, you know, they talk you through this thing. And I thought, oh, gosh, this is hokey. But by cracky, I feel a little more calmer coming out of there. That kind of let me get to the point where I realized my first marriage was a mess. It was just, it was, again, just, it wasn't working for both of us, and we both knew it. And I got out of that. And another friend of mine said, well, maybe you're ready. Here's the therapist I went to. They're really good. I got to warn you, though, it works. And I go, oh, that was scary. But I went in, and it's it was a kind of cognitive communication therapy, very much based on me telling my truth to one other person who was this very talented listener. 10 sessions, less than 10 sessions. I think it was about 8 sessions, changed my life. I knew my marriage was over. I needed to sort stuff out. And through that person, I was connected into a bunch of workshops where big name, Enlightenment Intensive was the name of them at the time, which was, again, this is the late 60s.
Yeah, 70s. Cool. No, it's awesome. Yep. Just let her rip. Who cares about
so,
what?
So, and so the funny thing was, it was basically a 3-day retreat where you're doing a combination of communication work and contemplation work. And it fried my gourd. And I was warned that, again, this is therapy that may work. You should be warned. Because I've learned, Jeff, over the years, many people do therapy to tell other people they're doing therapy, but they're not doing the work. This is a number of times. Lots of my friends, I myself have caught myself doing it. It's this lovely thing. Boy, you need help. Don't worry, I've got a therapist. You know, but you're not really digging in the dirt.
Got it.
You're going in there and listening to a therapist blab. So this stuff worked, and I ended up doing probably about, I don't know, 50 of these workshops over 2 decades. 30 of them I was staff member. So I was trained, became staffing. And then I'd go back every fourth time I staffed, I'd go back once to make sure I'm keeping the clock clean. I'm doing the work myself. And I think at the end of it is where I came out of that being much more clear. I'm me. This is how it works. This is how other people tend to work. This is kind of how life works. And I went into a period where I knew I was different, but I wasn't making myself wrong about it. And I wasn't making others wrong about how I was showing up or how they perceived me. And that was, as you might imagine, was a major, major shift. It took a couple decades, but it changed things.
But all while this time, you might have been clear, but you still didn't know what the difference was. Like, it's still nothing was, you know, you think you had all these speakers or workshop leaders or spiritual leaders, and you think like they would say, you deal with this, and you would go like, Eureka, I deal with this, and this is called blank. That didn't happen. So, was it bits and pieces? I'm a little bit of this.
Well, really important part, all the work I did, and I still support this work. I'm trained in this kind of therapy and that. Part of the thing is they don't tell you anything. That's what I immediately loved about it. It's self-discovery. You figure your own. In fact, as I got trained in it, there's so much you don't tell someone how it is. It isn't like you go to the guru and the guru says, you are pure love and this and that, which actually may be absolute truth, But it's different when you're just put in a room and you're faced with yourself through reflective dialogue, that you end up clearing all your own stuff off of your plate. So that's important to get, that I was never told anything. This is, I think, the fact that I discovered this in myself gave it weight. That it would have been different if someone says, hey, it's like when people do acid, I listen to their experiences. They have a lot of the same experiences we went through on like 3 or 4 day heavy duty workshop. The difference is their part of the brain afterwards is, whenever they think, oh, well, it's all love, their brain goes, that's the drugs talking, dude. Mm-hmm. When you do it without drugs, like we didn't even have coffee. We had to get off coffee. You weren't allowed to smoke. You didn't. It was really weird at first. But when you find yourself through yourself, there's nobody to whisper in your ear, here's the excuse why that's bullshit. Is all you, that's why I love that work.
Cool. No, that's yeah. Excellent. That's excellent because so – now as we get older and you move on and more is known about mental health and depression and anxiety and all of that stuff, did that ever enter your realm and say, bingo, like, first of all, as we know, over 90% of individuals on the spectrum at some point deal with mental health issues.
Yes. Yeah. So this is important. So what happened with me, again, keeping in mind at this time, I didn't have a diagnosis. I've been diagnosed bipolar. I've been diagnosed ADHD. There's been a lot of misdiagnoses, and I did the meds for them, and it was a nightmare because it wasn't the right shoe for this foot, so to speak. So what I tell friends is, you know, I've done enough therapy for about 3 lifetimes. The only weird thing was only about a third of it worked because – example, you know, one of my metaphors I used with the FESD, you know, I'm a car, a standard 5-speed transmission car, but the factory forgot to put in the third gear, but nobody told me, nobody told anybody. So I'm trying to drive like a normal driver. All I have to learn is jump from 2 to 4. So a lot of my therapy that was set for third gear work never worked. Mm. But because I didn't know about my diagnosis, I made myself wrong again. What the fuck's wrong? Why can't you get third gear, dude? What's wrong with you? My inner dialogue. So that's where the diagnosis freed up a lot of the reasons why a lot of my therapy just never would work that way.
And you did get other diagnoses. So you'd go and do the assessment and then they'd say, oh, we think it's this. And you're like,
here's a handful of lithium. Take it for the rest of your life. You know,
and you're like, it's not this.
No. And after a year of, one of my favorite stories is getting a really, really cool psychiatrist. I knew normally a psychologist person. I like being that, and I like doing that work. But a psychiatrist was interesting. I surrendered to this really interesting New Zealand guy. And, he says, okay, you're bipolar. You're going to be on lithium the rest of your life. I said, you may be right in the first part, but not the second. And I said, how about we make a deal, which normally they don't do, I found out. I said, I'll go on lithium for 1 year so I can find out where center is. Because apparently I've never been in center. I'll find where center is. Then I'll keep coming to you for 1 year while I take the power of finding my own center. And he kind of laughed. And he says, and if you can't, I said, I'll go on lithium again. I'll stay on lithium. So I did the year of lithium, which was absolute hell. But I got a sense of what
third gear. What a great metaphor. That's I'm gonna use that incredibly.
Please do.
And that just speaks to arousal. That speaks to emotional regulation, right? Like and not being able to, and then going from second to third gear. So you spent a year in third. And you didn't like it.
No. But he kept his word because I had learned a lot because, again, I'm also doing the other cognitive therapies and stuff. I learned how to pay attention to myself. I got the idea of what the lithium was trying to do. But the point is, because I didn't have that wasn't the issue with my brain. There's a piece missed. The gear is missing.
Yeah.
But I got if I'd had a gear, this is what the lithium would be trying to get me to do. So then I spent a year basically self-monitoring, self-modulating. And he said, you got to figure it out. And at the end of the year, we shook hands and he says, good luck with your life. And off we went into other crises because I still hadn't had my diagnosis because, you know,
third
year
was
still missing.
Let's go. We've set this up. Now, you are at this point, you are a multimedia artist. That includes, you know, video editing. You were doing some work with Queen's University editing. I think it's the Kids Brain health network.
That's exactly.
I think that's what it is now.
Yeah.
Now, bring me there.
Near DevNet. Now it's, yeah.
Yeah, bring me there. And you are, so you went through all this and you figured, this is who I am. This is what's going on. This is just another gig, right? In terms of here, you know, paying the bills, edit this video for this university, and then just take me there. And what are you hearing? Yeah. And you're going.
So I got hired by at the time they're called NeuroDevNet, which became the Kids Brain Network thing. And Dr. James Reynolds was kind of the peak worker or the head researcher there. And his assistant, Sue Kobus, who's charged to work with me, they had a whole bunch of videos that they'd had shot different locations. Bluntly, some of it really bad. You know, people had handy cams and that wasn't their fault. They're not video people. Mm-hmm. I got hired to try to polish them up, clean them up, fix the audio, try to fix the lighting, and edit this together. And Sue is the producer on it. And I'm cutting this stuff and hearing all these interviews and all this stuff. And I'm going, I remember distinctly one point leaning over to my friend Sue, she became a friend, and going, I feel like I'm editing my own life here. And it was one of those weird moments in life where it got really quiet, all the other noises in the room. And she just remembers Sue's blue eyes looking at me. She says, huh. It was one of those humps that go down your soul. It was like she didn't knock it off. She didn't blow it off. She didn't go, oh, Rainier, you're just – it was like, huh. And through that, the conversation came up, have you ever thought about getting a diagnosis? Well, now, in 19 – when the heck was that? That was 96 or 97. Back then, it was really hard for adults to get diagnosed. It almost impossible. That started about a 3-year journey for me.
But we're okay. So, but you're watching this and he's talking about, I'm imagining, what happens to the brain and, you know, the primary characteristics. And were you like, that's me, that's me, that's me. Like, when did you,
oh, totally. Yeah. I'm going, shit, I did that. Oh shit, I did. But then it became more interesting when I started going, I do that. You know, did that is one thing. You know, I did that. I mean, it's true. I don't run up to people and start talking to them randomly anymore. I mean, I have better social techniques now, but I did that. I still do that. I still am an incorrigible interrupter. I am still, you know, 3 steps ahead of everything going on. I still have absolute total anxiety that I'm doing it wrong, no matter what I'm doing. I can have people applauding me when I rock and roll accordion and I still, oh God, I messed that up. All these things, I do that was a big part of it while I'm editing these videos, you know. And then I got more involved when doing more videos, we started interviewing people. So when we started interviewing people, where actually I was also part of helping with the questions in that, all of a sudden it's different when you're in cutting video of people doing this kind of situation. But when we started actually meeting people, like Angels book? Bonnie Weston. So we interview Bonnie and her daughter. And Colette. What an amazing woman.
Yeah, she's on the podcast, one of the episodes.
Oh, woo, she's awesome.
Yes.
But to actually start meeting people like me, that really started shifting. This part in me is kind of going, wow, I am the same as somebody else. I'm not the same as most of the people I hang out with, but this is not a rare item that I was diagnosed with. So this is a situation where, again, the gift is starting to come back to me that this is my superpower. You know, they're starting to show me that they're not broken. Neither am I. There's nothing broken here.
Who looked for answers for decades.
Yeah.
Did you perseverate? Were you stuck? Like, am I FASD? Is this talk of my mind? Did you turn into the internet FBI agent and start you just let it come?
I basically started doing as much research on the FASD topic as I could at the time. But again, because I was doing this work with Sue Kobus and the Queens, I was able to start meeting all these people. I got invited to an all-day seminar in FASD. And so I got to listen to all these lectures and I got to fill out, you know, these forms and starting to actually do my own checklist, which was kind of designed for them to give to their charges. Well, I actually filled it out there. And I'm going, holy smokes, I'm hitting like 33 behaviors out of 36 here. So it's what happened was, in a very short time, I went from I didn't know this universe existed to, oh my God, I've been soaking in it my whole life.
Yeah, geez, that happened with me. I had the similar experience. Well, I thought I learned about FASD when I was a foster parent, yet yeah. My siblings, I believe, especially one of my siblings is on the spectrum. I've like, yeah. I've been dealing with this my whole...
Isn't that amazing?
Like I've been a caregiver. I've been on the trenches my whole life. It didn't yep. just start at this point. No. So you go to a clinic, like, were you convinced? You're like, man, this is me.
Yeah. And it was, to be clear, it wasn't this is me. This is very important from my experience. Sure. It was this is revealing the parts of me that I've been looking at.
And right.
I had the wrong bloody lens on the camera.
Right.
You get okay. it? It's yep. the same subject in front of the camera, same camera body, but I had the wrong lens on. The distortion was therefore I'm not getting the accurate photo of what's in front of me. And this became this, it was almost like, you know, the veils were lifted.
Yeah, that's
what's the, behind
you
the veil put is the same.
You've did the focus just that little bit.
Yeah.
Was it exciting? Was it scary? Like, what were you, was it validating? You know, I could only imagine 5 decades and then you're like, well, I might be looking at the answer here.
It was all of those things, Jeff. It was all of those. It was like, oh, fuck. And oh, fuck.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck.
Right.
You know, it was just there's a funny skit about the word fuck, which is how variable and how multi-use it could be. That's what I went through, all these different aspects of the aha moment. I've had yeah. other deep aha moments in my life, but usually they're on a hot point and it's like, wow, there it is. This was broad is the best
this
way
was the emotional spectrum of fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. and through my whole life, all the way back before yeah. I wasn't Jeez. Allowed to use the word.
So
it shoots forward, it shoots yep. backwards is the best way. It's out of time. I think I've never thought of it until just now. It was a realization that was out of time for me. It didn't establish me now. It didn't establish me ahead. It didn't establish me behind. It established all those aspects of myself.
Oh, crazy. So you go yeah. and do the assessment, but what about confirmation of prenatal alcohol exposure? How is that? And I know you're super close to your mom. My condolences, by the way. How did you have that conversation? What did that look like?
Well, as I mentioned, once I started doing the first initial videos, doing the fix-up work on other people's interviews, and then when we started doing our own interviews, there was a, you know, this was a gradual buildup over a couple years. Mm-hmm. So what I first started doing, one of the first things I did, I sat down with mom and, hey mom. So, and to be clear, my mom and I were not close until probably the last 15 years of our relationship. Wow. So in fact, because of this alien, I couldn't stand my parents for most of my adult life. And vice versa, they were conflicted. But sure. We always could talk. My mom had always been clear, if you need to talk, I'm here. So I sat down and we had the talk. So mom, I'm just curious, how much did you drink when I was, when you were pregnant with me? You know, our first was, I didn't drink, you know? And I thought, oh, that kind of shoots the whole thing in the head.
Right.
And this is part of my nature, I think, as an FASD kid that I didn't know. I would give up quickly on things. Ouch, this is too hard. No, I give up. So sure. I gave up for a bit. But then I, you know, we'd be going through some family pictures, you know, a few months later, and there's, you know, them with their martini glasses, and I'd say, I remember you guys every Saturday, you made us kids go upstairs, and you adults always had like a, oh, that was our weekly martini and cribbage party, you know? Oh. And I remember it was really sly of me, I feel, although I don't know if I meant it on purpose, but I said at one point, oh, so I guess when you were pregnant, you know, you'd stop doing the parties and that. Oh no, why would I do that? Mm. Oh, and I said, oh, so you'd have your martini. Oh, of course, that was martini and cribbage. And so I found this really non-blaming way to kind of go in there. Oh, she would basically every week have her couple martinis.
It's like motivational interviewing is what you're describing.
Exactly.
No, yeah. You are describing that. Mm. You talk, don't ask. It's like when you're talking to a maternal mother, you don't ask directly. You ask about, tell me about your pregnancy. So, right, exactly. So you're so exactly. sly, you're so smart, you didn't even know. Good for you.
Yeah. So what happened was, what led around to a video that a number of people have seen now, which is an interview with me and my mom. What it led around to at one point, I said, Mom, this is, you know, this is really important to me, and it may be important to you, but I just want you to be as loose and open about, you know, what were you doing at these parties? And it was actually really easy for her. She says, well, yeah, of course I had that. And I says, well, have you heard of this FASD? No. So I gave her some pamphlets, and you know, next thing you know, she's crying, she's upset. And we had a really good talk, and she said, I didn't know. And I said, I absolutely know you didn't know. And she got instantly, there's no blame. I wasn't looking for a bad guy. But I said, Mom, you know, for me to go further in finding out how accurate this is, you know, I just need you to be willing to answer the simple question. Did you drink any alcohol when you were pregnant with me? Well, obviously, yes, I did. And I says, that's all I need to be able to tell the doctor, you know.
Yep. And then you only have to say it once.
Yep.
And you only ever have to say it once. And anybody ever asks you, tell them to read the freaking file. Donald DeBolt taught me that.
That's right. That's true.
You don't have to keep people don't have to keep telling your story. No. You don't have to justify the journey.
No, but important on this was that it was actually probably about more than 6 months later. My mom did that interviews, which I love that about my mom. God bless, rest her soul. God bless her. She, when I came to her about the interview, because my friend Sue's going, you need to be interviewed now. And I'm like, ah! It's like, I had to get on the other side of the camera. You know, then it was one thing to ask my mom, did you drink? But the other thing, will you actually go public?
Yeah.
And
on record.
This is, I think, one of the major functioning changes in my relationship with my mom was, again, if you watch the video, there's remorse there, but she didn't beat herself up. She spoke her truth, which I didn't know. And if I could have known that this would have happened to you, you know, and she just, from her soul, saying, I would never have made those choices if I had had the education, you know. So that helps me be an advocate right now a lot more so, because I want mothers to know this out there, people who are planning on getting pregnant.
Agreed. Now, so they're reading the results and they confirm it. And what's that moment like? Like, it's,
I still remember Dr. Valerie Temple was the one who, I started up with Brenda Stade, she was the one who started the one side of the interviews down in Toronto. I had to travel to Toronto for this. And it was interesting. And then Valerie took over for the second half. And I remember we had to sit in a little room at St. Michael's. And she had all the paperwork there. And she starts going over all this charts on, like, interesting stuff. And she kind of looks up and it's kind of like, yeah, you're on the spectrum. And I just remember this. It's a weird feeling. It was not relief. It was just, there it is. Mm. You know, it is.
Confirmation.
I felt like I now could be more accurate in, because I'm until the day I die, I'll be self-exploring myself. That's who who I am. I also, if anybody comes to me who wants help with exploring themselves, I'm glad to support them in finding the same tools. But it's really helped clear up a lot of wasted energy that I was putting into my life. You know, I'm not, no longer will I worry about where the fuck is that third gear?
Yeah, a lot of.
I mean, it's unbelievable how much energy, Jeff. I don't know how to get across to people sometimes. How at points in my life, my entire being was focused on, fuck, I gotta find that third. Without that, I might as well kill myself. Literally, this is making me not able to be here with my fellow human beings. I gotta find third. So when you find out, you don't got it, dude. It was like, oh, I can stop looking,
and you don't need it.
I've been driving really, really quite amazingly well without it.
Yeah. Now you're
feeling shame, but feeling shame because I was doing it that way and going, no, dude, that's how you do it.
Yeah. You're trying to, because you think third gear is normal and you don't even need it. In fact, wow, that's incredible. So this just opens up this whole world, a little bit of peace. You are, you know, you explore yourself personally. That's awesome. But now you have the right lens, I think.
Well, it's a lot cleaner. Yeah. I never thought of it until just now when you said it that way. I think what happened is I finally got rid of the lenses, period. I'm just dealing directly. I'm working on the film and the camera now, so to speak. I'm not even going through lenses anymore. There's still no translation or inversion of the image. There's really, it's almost like I'm down to the film level now. What am I? Who am I that's been capturing this life? That's Rainier.
Who? So then,
so the film,
Are you telling people around you? This is my point. Are you telling people around you? Because you get to a point where you're like, now I advocate. So I don't think someone said you're FASD and you walked out the door and said, I must tell the world.
Yeah. No, I never became because I think back in my earlier working with the spiritual retreat work and the cognitive therapies and all that, I became a bit of what I call a spiritual bully or a therapist bully. You need to do therapy. Everybody does. And it was, you know, the finger pointing energy. And I learned, one of my teachers taught me once, it's never will work. Even if they do get it again, it won't be because they decided they needed to do it. And so this was very similar, Jeff. What I wanted to do was to be an advocate for people who have questions, as you're doing today. I will try to be an open book for my experiences. You take with it what you will, you know. And the truth is, because of the pandemic, I was just kind of getting rolling when you and I did that work up north there together with RJ. I was so excited because I felt this is part of my calling. It's still there, but the pandemic really squashed.
Same. Yep. No, yeah. I was privileged enough to witness that when you were stoked. You're like, this is a paying gig for something. Yeah. You told me this is a paying gig for something that I struggled with to find this my whole life. And now you said I'm hiding from this person for so long. And now I'm getting paid to, you know,
expose me.
Or share your absolute self in your experience, because your experience is, well, the journey might be different. The feelings are still the same for other individuals on the spectrum. What happens is that when parents are listening and this sounds amazing, but you had 56 years to mature. It's much different when an individual might get a diagnosis at an earlier age, and then there is that grief and that loss and that, you know, at first the denial and you were coming at this with open arms, like your wingspan was like, you know, like a big net. I want to find this. And so now you do speak about it and you do videos on it but you show other sides of your personality. What is your message when you're talking on stage to people? When you leave, you want them to know blank about FASD?
It's being refined over the last couple of years. My slogan on my website that I deal with this advocacy work is below the neck and above the waist living. I really am an advocate for the heart of dealing with this. I think a lot of caregivers and perhaps adults on the spectrum, we try to use our brains to think of the solution, to understand cognitively and all that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what I find the problem is, we're using something that inherently has problems. Even if you're neurotypical, you're still, sorry, everybody out there, you're still fucked in some way or another. Because do I know? You're on Earth. You're on Earth. Okay. So the thing is, the brain is a very challenging tool. But the heart, this is my experience. A lot of my work has found out my gut instinct, my heart, that deep intention that is me, it doesn't have mental illness. It can't, your heart can't get mentally ill. Actually, the heart doesn't get confused. We say, oh, I'm confused. My heart's torn. No, your brain is translating your heart right now, and it's confused. It's the old thing. When you flip a coin, you know, your brain goes, oh, I don't know what to do. And you get your heart tells you right away, oh, I'm disappointed with that flip, or I'm happy with that flip. You already knew. So a lot of my advocacy work right now is working with, especially caregivers in that, you know, they get frustrated with their charges. They get frustrated with the kids. They get frustrated with the adults. It's like, that's because you're still thinking you're going to find a way to think you find a solution. You've got to keep your head going, but drop into your heart here. And you've got to read this much more holistically than you've ever done, because the solution won't probably come from your brain. It certainly won't come from theirs.
Yeah.
That's a key chunk of where I'm finding my message to people. It's not knowing the data and all the stats. I mean, people like you are brilliant at that too. That's not my job here. My job is to re-inspire people that you're dealing with a conscious being, and their brain is not a signifier of their ability of consciousness. If that makes any
sense. Yeah, it doesn't. The brain doesn't make the whole human.
Not at all.
That's what you're saying, right? The illogical folks like me. That is an important message. So using the heart, really think with the heart that, and like you said, I think a big message is maybe quote unquote neurotypicals don't know how hard folks on the spectrum are working.
I think it's really important if you've got someone that, and again, I'll say, apparently I do this, you know, I am highly functional enough. I've learned enough tricks. I'm smart enough, whatever, that I fool my friends still to this day constantly.
Yeah.
To the point that I forget. I've trained them to look at me a certain way. It's not like I want to walk around with an FASD tattooed on my forehead. But part of the challenge is when I have a rough week, it's really hard to find friends that can be with me because they go for the neurotypical solutions.
Got it.
Really what I just need is, and you've just nailed it, actually, you helped me right here, is sometimes I need my friends to go, oh, fuck, man, that must be so hard with what you're dealing with. And it's not a pity cookie. It's just there's times where I feel so alone in my management of myself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's like what you would say to, I feel it's like if I just watch somebody run a marathon or do one of those mud runs or do a really long endurance thing, and at the end they're like exhausted and they're and I man, that's hard. Like I have the same that must have been such a grind to do it, you know, because even as quote unquote, you know, myself, we still struggle and I still grind and I, you know, I still get tired and all of that stuff. And so when I say you're constantly running this race, though, you know, you're constantly you have to work twice as hard. And but I'm just glad that now you could be your true self. What do you tell folks on the spectrum when you talk to them? Because I know parents are thinking, man, you're sharp, like, you know, cognitively, you're doing all this. Like, what do you tell? Because the spectrum is different, right?
So there's two things that are going on. So one thing is what I tell, and another thing is what I show. And that second one's important. I'm going to hit that one first, because when I did that first talk, my first professional speech, you know, where I was rewarded fiscally for sharing myself, I had so many responses from parents and caregivers in the group that just said, you just standing up there changed our relationship with our kids, because right now we're going, this kid's not going to make it to 20. This kid, there's no way this kid can survive just by you being 50 at the time, 57 or 58 years old. So that's me showing up, seems to have some value, and being clear that I'm in the spectrum, you know, I'm not high. This is me. What I tell people, you know, is a little different, because what I find is each individual that comes to me, again, I trust my heart. My brain will have, I have responses. I'm pretty, you know, I got some patter, but what I've learned is, the pattern needs to go through my heart filter or that thing for each individual, which means I need to pay attention to them. And sometimes it's easy, Jeff's, and sometimes I can tell I'm not going to reach this one, you know, and that's hard. I'm still learning. I'm new at this advocacy stuff. Uh-huh. I'm still learning how to protect myself because I can't help everybody. I may not be able to help anybody. Huge.
Yep.
And again, from my other work as a therapist in other realms, I understand that. But now in this realm, it's a little different. So, you know, what I tend to say to people is, you know, I've talked to some young adults and some adults, and it's kind of like, I hate to say the know thyself, but it really comes down to find it. Like, I'm missing third gear. Maybe you're missing fourth. Maybe you're not missing a gear. Maybe your tires are flat and they've got a leak and you'll never plug that leak. So you've got to figure out how to run on soft tires.
That's right. Maybe your brakes aren't very good.
Yeah, exactly. So I think part of my my hopes for my advocacy is that I always to have that ability of practicing what I preach and really involving that deeper intuitive part of myself in supporting people. It's very easy for me to go up into my head and, you know, especially white male, you know, of a certain age, it's very easy to me to mansplain FASD to people. I don't want to do that. I want to find something that it might just be a sentence. This is what I'm learning. Just the right sentence. And people, you know, the tears come and it's like, oh, I didn't think anybody else understood that, you know? And that means so much on the other side. I know, because that's what happened to me.
Like a conduit of understanding.
Yeah. Any good therapist, the only reason it worked is because some other human got you for a second.
Yeah.
Without judging it. Yeah.
Well done. What's next? Because this isn't the end. It's like, you're always,
I'm a little, yeah. So right now I have to admit I'm a little, this pandemic has stuck me a bit. I don't function well. I'm enjoying this today, but this kind of modality of communicating to other human beings through the screen doesn't reach me the same way. I find I doubt it'll happen today, but a number of times, you know, I'll leave actually feeling, now I remember what I'm missing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. You can see the energy. You can't feel it.
Yeah. So, that has slowed me down this year, but I'm really clear that, you know, I want to get back into doing more speaking gigs. I want to get on the ground. I want to go to, seminars and places where advocates, other advocates are there. I'm great to sit down with young adults. You know, I'm also clear in my market sounds terrible. Audience.
Yeah.
I know.
No, wait, you haven't gotten to our last segment. It's called the shameless self-promotion segment. So go. Yeah. So keep going.
All right. We'll get that. So the thing is, I want, what was I saying now? Sorry. I got sidetracked with the,
No, you're, it's about knowing your audience.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So the thing is, I want to be able to, talk to young adults and adults. I'm aware that my reach out isn't to the young kids. There's other, I'm glad to reach out to their caregivers. I think I can help there a lot. You know, I can really help say, this is what your kid's going through. I can speak on the kid's behalf, but directly to the kids, I'm clear, that's not my job right now. But once we get into a certain realm of self-awareness, you know, when that teenager, I mean, this is why I see so many kids, you know, around 13 to 18 years old, because they're starting to get, oh my God, this is my life. Oh, geez. That's right. The good news and the bad news. Mm-hmm. That's when I feel I can help, because there's a sense of responsibility. There's a seed in everyone. And my biggest fear is that they will be trained to not be responsible. I don't want to ever advocate for someone to use their disability as an ability to be a victim.
Oh, well said.
Thank you.
So it's empowering.
Yeah. So I do have this, it's not, I feel there's a superpower embedded in every disability, not just FASD. Anything that forces us off the run-of-the-mill normal grind, I think, can raise our ability as a human being to be a more interesting, effective human being. What? That's the bad, you know, the bad news is it's probably going to hurt a bit, but you will be better on the other side of this thing. So that's part of my advocacy too, is, and I find young adults are looking for that. The sad thing is, I'm noticing a few people I've met my age, there is a sense of giving up and, oh, fuck. You know, I still will be glad to speak to them. I will still try to do my best to remind them that, you know, as long as you're sucking air, you're not done.
Yeah, you're igniting that passion. That's true. And it's infectious. Like, your enthusiasm is. At the end of the day, enthusiasm, if you can't get them with understanding, get them with enthusiasm. And it's really a good tool. Last question before we do the self-promotion segment.
Sure.
What's your ego around having to be accommodated for some of the things that you might struggle with?
That's an interesting question. I guess the first thing I'd have to ask myself, do I subtly or overtly, like, say I need some compensation here? I think I do, only back, I mentioned it earlier, which is I think what I'm missing in my current social situation is people that remember I've got that noise in the background all the time. Even down to like body pains and, you know, fibromyalgia, all these other side things that seem to be coming out of this neurological situation I'm in. I miss that I kind of wish I would get more understanding without needing to go and remind people of it. I'm still reluctant to do that.
So your business partner, you trust her wholly with that though, right? And so when you say time, or I need to remember this, or
God bless her, she's got a son who is on the Asperger's. I don't know what it's called now, but on their own spectrum. So I think that's a great thing. We're very different, her son and I. We get along great, but she is aware of the non-neurotypical, you know, the atypical.
Got it.
Neuro, Yeah.
So accommodating is just something she does. It's doesn't even, it's water off her back. Yep. This is what we do. And you know, everybody needs it. I need it. I you know, we have Yvonne, obviously, who sets this up so I could be at my best and show my gold, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't have the energy on the actual scheduling part because that takes away from me being my best. So when we were coming up with what to call Yvonne, because I didn't want to call her my assistant or my, I don't like that word. So I was thinking, and then I said one day, you know, Yvonne, you're my external support specialist.
I love it. I think that was a great thing to
right. And so that's we all need those in our lives. So it just makes us better. So we can sit here and show our gold.
Yeah.
What now? It's time for the segment. Shameless self-promotion. What are you doing? Give us websites. Where do you want us to, my audience to go? You know, what are
perfect. Got it.
All of this. Let her rip.
Two places. One is in my, from the multimedia artist that I am. That's brilliantie.ca. So brilliantie.ca. And that's where you'll find all the multimedia stuff I do, photography, video, and everything. My partner's company that we do a lot of co-work with is C3 Inc. Just the letter C3INC.ca. And her line of stuff is she's a communicator. She's a writer. She's the one that figures out how to take an hour-long interview and get it down to 3 minutes of succinct stuff. And then she hands me a sheet, and I got to cut it so it makes sense.
Got it. Yeah, so she squeezes it, and you cut it.
You got it. So that's the multimedia end of me. The other side of me, the below the neck and above the waist living part of me, is awesomeawareness.com. And that's C-O-M, not C-A-L-M, because that would have been too witty.
Yeah.
So awesome awareness. And that's where I do my advocacy work. That's where I talk about, you know, it's not just FASD, but men's mental health, mental health in general. I call it, you know, how to be a better human being at the end of the day than you were the day before, you know? So
awesome. And you have a YouTube channel because you've got stuff on there. That's good. If you search your name in at YouTube, there's stuff. Yeah.
I think that's my other thing. Would just search Reinier, R-E-I-N-I-E-R, D-E-S-M-I-T on YouTube. You'll get a bunch of little things all over the place.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. So if somebody wants to work with you on any part of the spectrum, how do they get a hold of you?
Both websites have email links. You can send me an email there. That's the best way. Reinier, actually my main email is Reinier, R-E-I-N-I-E-R at brilliantie.ca.
Awesome.
And feel free to send me an email. And again, I'll do my best. I'll also be very honest. If it's not a good fit, I'm learning very easily to gently just say, I don't feel the love in this. So I'm, can't help you.
I 100% get it. And we'll make sure we have all this stuff on our blog at fasdsuccess.com/podcast. And we'll have Reinier's blog accompanying the episode with all of the links. So you did it. Hey, thanks for doing this, dude.
Thanks, buddy. No, it really, it's been 2 years since we worked. Yeah. A year. There's been a couple things we've done, and I appreciate you a lot too, dude. It's fun. I do feel a kindred spirit in this, and I love the way we interrupt progressively and upwardly.
Yes, we are professional interrupters.
Yes, we are.
Well, thanks for doing this. Will you come back on?
Anytime, buddy. Anytime.
Yeah. Thank
you. This was a good experience for me. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you, dude. Oh, Reinier, thank you so much, man. That was so good. I hope you guys loved it. I loved it. What great insight. I was writing down notes like crazy listening to this because at the end of the day, individuals on the spectrum are the experts. They are the experts. They live with it every day. And he has a great way of articulating what that's like, what he's dealing with. But let's start off with how cool is that to change your name at 40, right? We talked about my birthday is, I guess, whenever you, on the 15th. A couple of weeks. I said a week, but it's a little bit later than that. I digress. Anyway, that'd be like me changing my name. Like, what would I call myself? I don't know. I don't think I will tell you this though. My mom told me a story that because I have two older sisters that they wanted to call me Porridge. Thanks for not taking their advice, Mom. So I would have been Porridge James Noble. That would have been great. Great name. But that's cool. At 40 years old, change your name. Takes balls to do it. I dig it. But listen, he said a lot of cool things. And I think it's important to realize, he said, well, my IQ was high. My IQ was high while this mental storm was going on. We put so much emphasis on intelligence and smarts and smarts and smarts because we hear that all the time. My kid's so smart. My kid's so smart. And I'm sure that is, right? We know individuals on the spectrum from verified from Dr. Katie Flanagan in our Justice show just a few episodes ago that, you know, average to low moderate IQ. So absolutely. But there's more than just IQ going on. He said there was this mental storm. And I that's a great way to describe, I'm sure, what some of your kids are going through on a daily basis like that. He says, my FASD engine is always running, and it takes a lot of energy to manage that. And that sort of was the theme, wasn't it? And he wanted to emphasize a lot and how taxing it was when he wasn't able to be his authentic self, how taxing it was to be able to be an adult and to run his business and to put food on the table and to, you know, have a stable placement while all this is happening in the background. I like that theme, being your authentic self. Well, I think he had a good point. You can't always be your authentic self because sometimes you got to be professional and sometimes the situation calls for you to be not your truly authentic self, because who knows what that would look like, especially for me. I'm a degenerate. What else he was talking about, you know, when he was talking about meeting somebody in terms of having a friend, when he was talking about having that one person that he could talk to, I really like what he said. What are you thinking about my thinking? I think that's really what it comes down to in terms of mentorship, in terms of having an external support specialist for your loved one on the spectrum, or if you are on the spectrum for you. What are you thinking about my thinking? Because oftentimes it's the thinking that is the disability. And so to have somebody to bounce that off of is so key. And I know it's tiring, especially for caregivers who have to be that and everything else. But if an individual can find somebody, a partner, a big brother, you know, one of those, a mentorship program of somehow, and I know it's easier said than done, but that's really the goal, to work through their thinking. He also said, I'm like a 5-piece band and I have to manage myself. I just kept picturing, you know, struggling with 5 instruments. And just what great metaphors. What great metaphors. And the story about his mom, with his mom and them not having a relationship only until really the last 15 years. And then finally finding out that there was some prenatal exposure, a confirmation of prenatal exposure. And his mom said, I would never have made this choice if I had the education. Think about it. You know, I believe I have siblings on the spectrum. My mom was the same way, right? They didn't know any better because the education wasn't out there. Sometimes I feel so alone in the management of myself. Man, that hit me like a ton of bricks. And I bet you, as a caregiver, you feel that way as well. Sometimes you feel so alone in managing everything. Sometimes you know, feel alone for having to be the thinking brain for everybody in your family, and you are dog tired, but you are here. You're still learning. You're still trying to fill your cup. You're still trying to move forward, and you're not giving up, and I think that's admirable. And, you know, I guess the theme in this podcast is about age and about maturing. And listen, however old you are, you're still here. You're still doing it. And you're doing it well, because if you weren't doing it well, it would be a lot worse. And you say, Jeff, my situation is awful right now. But we're only a few decisions away from being out of it. And we're only a few mindset changes from feeling different about it. That's what we got to work on. And so it's important to keep listening to, you know, the podcast. What's even better is if you're doing it while you're walking or you're doing something physical as well, and you're burning all that cortisol and you're pumping all of those endorphins and dopamine and all that good stuff to your brain. That's when it's really good. it's also important just to be listening. If you're doing dishes or driving or whatever it is you're doing, you're filling your mind with the good stuff and you're blocking out the negatives that you are getting from elsewhere, from other people, from the school, from spouses. You got to focus up, listen to the war song, and keep going. This right here is the war song, man. You guys are awesome, especially if you're on, you know, the end of show crew here and you're listening right to the end. That just means you're automatically 32% better. Not than everybody else, but you know what I'm saying. You have a buff. You have a bonus attribute. Okay, I've been playing a lot of video games. There isn't much less to do. I love them, but I digress. And I guess that's what I'm doing. I'm leveling up. You level up. Like, let's level up together. How do you do that? Is to not be isolated. Please join our group, facebook.com/group/FASD forever. Hook up with us there. Make sure you're subscribing to the show. You drop me a line at jeff@FASDforever.com just to say hi. I love it. I'll do my best to answer. But keep swinging. Keep grinding. We are getting through this. You could do this. Mental health above everything. You got it. I got you. I love you. And I will see you again this time next week. All right. We'll talk then. All right. Bye.